Hello and welcome to The Road to Autonomy. I'm your host, Grayson Brulte. The Road to Autonomy is brought to you in part by Stantec Generation AV. Stantec Generation AV combines some of the most experienced AV experts in the industry with the resources of a global engineering firm. Stantec Generation AV provides education, consulting, assessment, and guidance to any industry interested in autonomous vehicles. Learn more at stantec.com. Hello and welcome to The Road to Autonomy. I'm your host, Grayson Brulte. On today's episode, we're absolutely honored to welcome back Russ Mitchell from the LA Times. Welcome back, Russ.
Hey, good to be here, as always.
This is four times. This is awesome. My God. You're the leading guest. This is fantastic. Every time you're on, we have fascinating conversations. We talk about all sorts of different things as it relates to mobility. And today, I really want to zoom in on electrification. You've done a really good job in the LA Times covering electrification, covering charger anxiety, which we'll get into in a minute. But on Tuesday, November 8th, voters in California are going to vote on Prop 30. It's going to raise taxes on California residents with annual income over $2 million by 1.75% to a state income tax of 15.05%. 80% of those funds will be used to subsidize electric vehicles and charging stations, and 20% for wildfire suppression and prevention. You're on the ground in California. You have a really good pulse. You work for a world-renowned paper that does, I'm going to call it, Tier 1 Grade A reporting. How are the voters currently leaning on the Prop 30 issue?
Well, the polls show that they're leaning in favor. The $2 million threshold probably is making people think that it's not on their back. So when I was a kid, a long, long time ago, there was a senator from Illinois where I grew up named Everett Dirksen. And during one of the tax debates, people were trying to shift around where the taxes would be applied. And his famous phrase was, "Don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that fellow behind the tree." So people that make $2 million or more in California in income every year are the ones behind the tree. So I don't want to minimize the idea that people in California care about the environment and they see this as a strike for the environment. So that's, I'm sure, their main motivation. But the fact that they won't have to pay for it probably makes it a lot easier to vote yes.
It's going to hurt a lot of small businesses that are LLCs because they're pass-through income and it's going to show up on their personal tax returns. And then I want to point out Lyft, the ride-sharing service, contributed $45 million to the Yes on Prop 30 campaign, by far the largest donor to the campaign. Why is Lyft putting so much money into Prop 30?
Well, the state is requiring the ride-hailing companies to, over the years, shift to an almost all-electric fleet. As everybody knows, the drivers, who aren't employees but contractors, buy those cars. So they want to make it easier for their drivers to be able to buy an EV and be able to use the EV.
But Uber's been silent. Uber hasn't put in $1 into Prop 30.
Yeah, and I talked to Uber about that. They sent me the usual anodyne corporate response saying they want to be team players on the environment. They didn't really go into great detail. They talked a little bit about how much they'll spend on the environment. All that can be done is speculation, but my informed speculation would be Uber has better access to capital than Lyft does. So if times get shaky and Lyft gets shaky and they can't get enough drivers because they don't have enough EVs, that helps Uber. And the less competition there is, the more Uber will have cash to maybe subsidize the EV owners by themselves. Also, the executives at Uber make more than $2 million a year. So, you know, they're looking at their own, I'm sure they're looking at their own bank accounts and their wealth accumulation and making calculations, and that may well be part of their decision-making.
Uber has better access to the capital markets. They have the Uber Freight business, which is going from $7.4 billion to $9.2 billion in revenue. They have the Eats business, which is growing. And then on the other side, you have Governor Newsom, governor of the state of California. He's very publicly come out against Prop 30. When I say publicly, he's doing mailers. He's doing video ads on TV and on YouTube. And in essence, Governor Newsom's bucking his own party on this. He is a staunch environmentalist, which has been well documented. He's questioning why Lyft is bankrolling the measure. Why is that?
Well, the Lyft is bankrolling the measure because it will help Lyft. And I think the leadership at Lyft from everything I've read, really is concerned about greenhouse gases and such. So there's that. But it definitely helps them. The thing is that Newsom is explaining his opposition by painting it very visibly as a corporate preference, corporate domination. Well, you know, if you looked at all of the corporations that Newsom and the Democrats and Republicans in the state have helped, corporation footprints are over everything. You look at so many propositions out there that have corporation money involved. I mean, it's a fact of life that has to either be dealt with or not dealt with. But he's not talking about the fact that people think he's going to run for president. He's not answering questions about where his money might come from and whether it's people who make $2 million a year or more might want to donate to his presidential campaign. Those are speculations, of course, but I think anybody out there would agree that those are the kind of questions that they wish the governor would respond to.
He should respond. You're an accredited news agency, and you should respond to those questions to yourself or to a colleague of yours at the LA Times, because it's all signs point and all the groundwork's being put for a 2024 presidential campaign. He's clearly thinking about it if President Biden opts not to run it. Perhaps Governor Newsom challenges him in a Democratic primary. He clearly has his ambitions set on D.C. And he's using the tagline in California, don't be fooled. Well, you're telling people not to be fooled by Lyft. Well, not be fooled that you're trying to run for the White House. You're kind of using a slogan that can go on either side of the aisle there. We talk about the electrification, the campaign with the Prop 30 where the drivers have to go all electric. I want to add some clarity for our listeners to that. It's 90% of miles logged by Uber and Lyft drivers have to be electric by 2030. And then to give more context to that, UC Berkeley partnered together with the LA Times and conducted a poll. And I want to read the results of this poll. Only 20% of California consumers plan to buy an EV as their next vehicle. If consumers opt not to buy a vehicle, the individuals opting in a rideshare service opt not to buy an electric vehicle, what's going to happen? Will Uber and Lyft cease? Will the business go? Will the rates go up? Market economics? What's going to happen?
What's going to happen to which? The mandate, no gasoline cars after 2035, or something else in particular?
I want to get into the 2035. Let's start with the Uber and Lyft drivers. What's going to happen to the service? Will the price be forced to go up because there's less vehicles?
Those are all very good questions. The law was passed, the arguments were made, and it's just expected to happen. It will be a political fight, both within the bureaucracy and in the legislature and in the governor's office, to deal with it if it proves impossible.
Expected to happen? Those are scary words.
Well, there's a lot in California that's expected to happen in terms of renewable energy, which I'm personally, as a citizen, very much in favor of. But as we've seen in Germany, if you don't plan well, you can get yourself in a situation where you've got energy inflation and energy shortages at the same time. And I think that California is risking finding itself in that situation. Now, in the past, California has changed direction when it's seemed that its tough mandates were not going to be met, including zero-emission vehicle mandates back 10 or 15 years ago or so. And the people in the various agencies have, in their presentations, noted as a sidelight that these things can be changed in the future. So, you know, there's some wiggle room if things are really taking a bad turn. The regulators and the rulemakers can decide to ease off if they need to.
While there's wiggle room, if the ban gets pushed back politically, what does that do to the sitting governor at that time? Does that put that governor in hot water because you have the environmentalists left that will be outraged?
Oh, they'll just point back to President Newsom.
Then what happens?
I can't predict the future. The future has never been easy to predict. I think that predicting the future is tougher than ever.
Well said, sir. What role is the California Energy Commission going to play in this? Are they going to set the standards? Are they going to set the charging rates? Are they going to enforce anything? What role will they play?
They're in charge of handing out subsidy money, basically. There's going to be some rules around it, and the new rules are being debated. There was just a hearing, they call it a workshop, just a few days ago, and they're taking input, and they will be coming up with plans to distribute billions of dollars to people who buy chargers over the next several years. The question is, how reliable will these chargers be? Because they're not very reliable right now.
They're not reliable. You've documented it in your September 22nd column called California's EV Charging Network Could Use a Jolt in a Trip Down I-5. Will reliability be mandated by the California Energy Commission if, let's say, the city of Bakersfield or the subsidy going to the local cafe, will there be mandates in there as the companies that are buying it for reliability?
Well, there's state money and there's federal money. In California, most of the money is coming from the state, but they're getting a pretty rich dollop from the two major infrastructure bills that were passed under the Biden administration. So they will literally have billions of dollars to spend. The federal government, for its share, which is something like $350 million for California, requires 97% uptime reliability, which sounds really good. But some of the discussion at the recent Energy Commission meeting was, how do you determine 97% reliability? And the charger companies are coming up with all kinds of different formula that would, in effect, as a consumer coming up to a gas pump, expecting that 97 times out of 100 it will be working, it may not be anywhere close to that. Those rules are being worked on. There's also apparently no real enforcement mechanism. And I've been trying to get detail from the Energy Commission on how existing, because there's been subsidies already, even in a situation where 25% or more of chargers just aren't working. And they claim that they have an ability to sue the companies, which is a drastic step. And so far, they have not done so. So basically, the charger companies or the people they sell the chargers to have enjoyed tremendous subsidies so far. They're performing poorly, and there seems to be no accountability for that.
No accountability. Suing's not accountability. It's not going to help the consumer that wants to go down the I-5, for example, or up the 101 to San Francisco. It's going to cause charger anxiety. They're going to be terrified when they get in their vehicle. Uh-oh, is the charger going to work? Uh-oh, is the charger going to work? When you took the Ford F-150 Lightning on down I-5 from Berkeley, California, were you experiencing charger anxiety? Uh-oh, am I going to get to my destination? Is the charger going to work? Did you experience any of that?
Well, you know, I've talked to people. There was somebody, we were waiting for the one working charger at a charging station. The cars were kind of lined up. They're actually parked in different spots because there wasn't enough room to line up. And they said, and this is true, I don't have range anxiety, because that's been the big phrase about electric cars, range anxiety. I have charger anxiety. And the fact is, the automakers are stepping up and coming out with cars that have ranges from 250, 350, in more expensive cases, even more than that. So they've stepped up, and range anxiety isn't the problem. When I took the trip down, I mapped out where all the chargers were, and it looked like a slam dunk. Even if I had to spend an hour at a charger, that would be fine. There are plenty of chargers on the way down. The problem is that a heck of a lot of them didn't work at all. And there was a situation where I had barely 15 miles to get to the next charging station, and I did make it, and that one was working. But I'm not sure what would have happened if I died in the middle of the road. I would have to call, use my AAA, and have them come out and help me.
You think about dying in the middle of the road with a vehicle, if an individual, in this case the driver, is not smart enough to pull over the side of the road, you've got a dead vehicle in the middle of the road. It's going to cause a traffic jam that could lead to crashes and potentially fatalities. How did we get here with charger anxiety? The pre-SPAC bubble, it was hyped charger companies are the new oil companies. And I sat down with a CEO and chairman of a very large charging company and with a friend of mine from one of the big oil companies. He said, we're going to put you out of business. And the gentleman from the oil company said, we pay a larger dividend every quarter than you've raised in your history. So if we really want to do this, we can buy you. There was a lot of animosity there. When you go to a gas station, I'm not going to use the word guarantee, but there's a 99.99% chance that you're going to be able to put gas in your car. You go to a charger, there's probably a 75% chance. How did we get into this situation, and how do we eventually fix it?
To be fair, it's a new market. Electric cars are fairly new in terms of customer acceptance. The whole charging industry is new. There'll be people entering the industry that may not be the best at execution. there may be people entering the industry that, because it's being subsidized, don't have the total incentives to make things work the way they ought to. You may have totally legitimate people running a company that cares about electric cars and the environment and wants to make them work, and they're finding that it's a lot harder than they anticipated. So there's lots of reasons why we're where we are now. The question is, with so many problems and with so many billion dollars raining down, is this going to be fixed? And that is really an open question. And the entire viability of the EV market is going to depend on the public charging situation and whether they can get it fixed. I should say we're talking about public chargers here. Most people that have chargers at home, it can be a hassle getting them installed, but once they're installed, they seem to work pretty well. It's the networked public chargers that are having the problems. And everything from manufacturing defects to hardware defects to software confusion to card readers that don't work, it's just kind of a mess.
It's all leading to charging anxiety. And to me, it's leading for an opportunity that Barron's highlighted on October 24th, which they said energy giants are putting their bunny cash to work in renewables. BP has acquired Amply Power. Shell's acquired Green Lots. Chevron's going to do something. Dan Ammann's now over at Exxon. Does this give an opportunity for big oil with all their cash to come in here, clean it up, put service level agreements where the consumer goes, I'm going to go to an Exxon charger. You know why? I don't like big oil, but it's reliable, and I know when I go there, it's going to work.
Yeah, they are getting involved. And in fact, Shell bought a company called Green Lots and has rebranded them as Shell Recharge, I think it is. Shell Recharge. And this is, on my trip, this is a scientific sample of one. So it really is an unreliable sample. But when I pulled into the one former Green Lots Shell Recharge station, every charger was working. Now, whether that is true across the board and they're much more reliable, I haven't seen any statistics on that. I just note anecdotally that every other charging company had problems one way or the other.
Politicians might lament the amount of cash the oil companies are making now, but they can afford to put service level agreements, have on-the-ground technicians, and have uptime. Because to me, the most important factor in all this, if you're a Shell or you're an Exxon or a Chevron, is the brand damage. Your brand is getting dragged through the mud every day. You want to ensure that your product, you can control your brand. So that's why the uptime, I think, becomes very crucial to them. You also did a trip. You did the trip down I-5 in California. You also did a trip through New England. Did you run into the same charging issues that in New England that you experienced on the I-5 in California?
Yeah, the same, if not worse. I was in a Hyundai Niro electric car. Excellent car. Plenty of mileage. We were driving from Boston to, my daughter is going to she's taking a semester to go to a high school in Vermont for one semester working on a farm and studying there. So we went to visit her. There were four Electrify America kiosks advertised in Manchester, New Hampshire. We pulled in. All four were dead. The screens were working on two. The screens weren't even working. They were completely dead on the two others. That's all there were there, and they were all dead. I called the customer service. They couldn't figure out. They couldn't say why they were dead. So we had enough mileage to get to the next Electrify America station with four kiosks. This was in, I think, Lebanon, New Hampshire. And there were four kiosks there. Only one was working. There was, I wouldn't say a line of cars. There were people parked over waiting for their turn to use the one. People were calling in, and they actually rebooted all four stations, and one of them, one of the non-working stations, came back on. But still, there were two working and two not working that entire time. So the trip took hours longer than we expected. And, you know, it wasn't just Electrify America. ChargePoint, they advertise all these public chargers, but most of them are 6-kilowatt chargers, which basically we plugged in. We were in Massachusetts, in Western Massachusetts, and we plugged in, and it said that it would take 17 hours to fill the car. So when you look at a charging map, they don't make it real clear because they use these technical terms like J with four numerals against it. But that means it's in effect, a trickle charger. Those are all over the place. ChargePoint has put those all over the place. They tend to work, actually, but it takes hours and hours and hours to get anything in your car. My encounters with ChargePoint, both on I-5 and on the New England trip, very unreliable. Sometimes they worked.
Sometimes their work is not good enough. 17 hours to charge is not good enough. If we want consumers to embrace low carbon, move to electric vehicles, we have to have 100% uptime on charging. Repeat, 100% uptime on charging. You cover Tesla a lot. How is the Tesla charging reliability? Are they pretty reliable as compared to their competitors?
Well, Tesla, and as you know, as we've talked in this program before, Tesla faces a lot of issues, including the quality of their cars, and the customer service aspects are pretty abysmal. But I have to say, on the charger side, Tesla is far away superior to anything else that's out there in terms of public charging. There are two main reasons. One is that they are an integrated company, so they can't point fingers at other players in the game. They don't sell their charger and put the responsibility on a retailer. They take charge of their own stations. There's another company, by the way, which in New England, I haven't seen these in California yet, but it's called Flow, F-L-O. It's a Canadian company in New England, which is also vertically integrated. And I found that the Flow chargers were very reliable. There weren't too many of them, but they were reliable. And if I saw that there was a Flow charger around, that's the one I would go to because I had more confidence that it would work. They're also vertically integrated. The second thing is it's unclear how to make money if you're not being subsidized. And Elon Musk, he's drawn his fair share of subsidies, but in terms of chargers, he's subsidized by the crazy equity investors who have made this, you know, this $1 trillion market value company. He had plenty of cash to lay these out, didn't have to make money on them. He could pay for this wide network out of that equity. So that's another reason that I think Tesla chargers, public charging, is a lot more reliable.
On the Tesla standpoint, the supercharger network, in my opinion, has given Tesla a competitive advantage for your consumer that's looking to buy an electric vehicle because they know the majority that those chargers are going to work. Ford is very bullish on their electrification future on their earnings call. Mr. Farley talked very bullish about it. Why did Ford not, or another large OEM for that matter, say, okay, we're going to vertically integrate, we're going to put Ford-approved chargers throughout the United States. So the individual of the new Mach-E or the F-150 Lightning knows they can charge. I know they have their Charge Angels program, but they're relying on third-party public chargers. Nothing has the Ford blue seal of approval.
Well, I shouldn't say nothing. You shouldn't say nothing because there are manufacturers, including Ford, Hyundai, and others that are installing chargers at their dealerships. So if you own a Ford and you go to a participating, that's the key, Ford dealership, you'll be able to charge your car there. And there are a lot of dealerships around. So they do have that. But I get back to the equity argument. All the other car companies are valued with some reasonable expectation of future cash flow. And Tesla is a meme stock company where a lot of people are buying in based on all kinds of full self-driving, driverless car, robo-taxi, million robo-taxis, all these exaggerations or even lies in some cases that make them believe the cash flow is going to be a lot more than it's likely to be. The regular car companies, the existing traditional car companies, their stock is based on more traditional cash flow values, so they don't have the access to the equity to be able to build out a charging network that probably would be a money loser.
I want to give you a historical example here, a well-known California company called Visa. It's everywhere you want to be, there's Visa. It was spun out of Bank of America and became Visa is an independent company. Do we perhaps see the OEMs get together in a cooperative, buy a bunch of these charging companies, develop their own, and operate as a co-op for that the vehicles are interoperability, and then the large OEMs come together and say, okay, we are going to guarantee a service up level. These are going to be controlled by this. Very similar to Visa. When you go to get a coffee, you know your Visa card's going to work. Or if you go to pay for your gas, your Visa card's going to work. Does some model like that eventually come out in the future, perhaps?
I could imagine several different models coming up. I know the OEMs have to be pressuring the charger companies to up their act because it's really going to affect the future sales of electric vehicles. Publicly, the car companies aren't going to criticize this because it's bad publicity. In some cases, when I talk to auto executives on the side, they'll tell me that they are quite concerned about reliability levels, but still they won't tell me what they're doing about it. I have no clue what their approach is to the charger companies. But they do know that if this isn't fixed, it's going to severely affect their ability to sell electric cars.
Broken chargers cause brand damage for the OEMs. They're mostly going to blame Ford or VW. They're not necessarily going to blame ChargePoint, which raises the question, we're seeing consolidation happen in the autonomous vehicle space. We've seen it happen in the micromobility space. When is consolidation coming to EV charging?
It depends on, well, I'm not against subsidies. I'm not for subsidies. I'm neutral on subsidies. I think anybody who looks at subsidies would see that in some cases they work very well in terms of moving a market forward. In some cases, it's just kind of a consumer ripoff or a taxpayer ripoff. Often it's a mix of the two. But the fact is, if these companies are being subsidized, they're going to, even if they're not good companies, they're going to stay in business longer. So you don't get the kind of harsh capitalistic forces at play that would force a consolidation. I should say on the brand image issue, which is big, it's not just OEM, you know, Ford, Hyundai brand, although there is that. It's a whole brand image of electric vehicles. And the state of California, as they put together their plans for charging and charging reliability, they need to keep, I think, this is an opinion, but they need to keep foremost in mind that if they want to meet the no gasoline cars requirement by 2035, they need to make sure that the idea of electric vehicles isn't destroyed, that that brand isn't destroyed by a poorly performing public charging network.
That's well said. Do not destroy EVs. EVs are incredible cars. They're cars that consumers want and eventually cars that consumers are going to purchase. And we're seeing this global shift towards renewable energy. I've always advocated for taking a moderate hybrid approach of using what source is the best. And you conducted a recent interview with Vlacos Schmil, the professor who's written tremendous books. I want to highlight that Bill Gates is a big fan. If you go on gatesnotes.com, you can read the wonderful reviews that Mr. Gates has about Vlacos Schmil's books. And in the interview, he said the following to you: in managing our energy affairs, we should constantly favor doable steps. In your opinion, what are those manageable, doable steps?
I think that everybody that's involved is trying to make doable steps. The question is, what's doable and what's not? What do you believe and what don't you believe? Schmil would say that, I don't want to speak for him, but what I take from what he has said is that human culture is on a consumerist, materialistic path that won't be changed readily. And that path relies, whether you want plastic, whether you want cement or fuel for cars, for power for, you know, for electrical generation, that is still tremendously dependent on fossil fuels. And the case of Germany shows that if you move too quickly to forms of energy that are not yet reliable, and I'm not saying don't move that way, and he's not saying don't move that way, but if you move too quickly, you can get yourself in a real bind where you have energy inflation and energy shortages. So the doable steps are to make sure that whatever is done, that you can keep the grid working, you can keep electric rates affordable, and use that as the base on which to grow out renewable energy, which is a necessary thing for human culture to do. The only alternative to that that I see is a drastic drawback in consumerism. And a lot of people might think that that would be a good idea. I personally think there's too much crap in my house. I buy too much crap. But, you know, I don't see any real sign that human culture at large is going to put the brake on that unless, you know, inflation and joblessness forces them to.
If you look at I go back to Visa again, you look at the latest quarter reports, spending is up. American Express spending is up. Consumers, even though we have inflation at 8.3%, we have the Fed raising interest rates, probably going to go by another 75 basis points. Consumers are still spending, which is mind-blowing. And we have to take doable steps to energy. We're going to learn a very hard, I'm going to call it a very sad lesson in Europe this winter. They're experiencing energy inflation. There's an energy shortage because they decided to go all in on something while not taking into account the realities of where energy is there. How do we avoid making those mistakes?
That's not a question for me. I'm a journalist. That's a good question for policymakers. It's a good question, though.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. You're a journalist. You live in California, so I'm going to ask this another way. What's the future of energy in California, and can California learn from Europe?
So California is moving headlong into renewable energy, solar and wind energy, and is a leader in that field, which is great. But they're counting on having plenty of battery storage for reliability at a time when materials that go into making batteries are short. There's lots of demand for batteries. It's unclear whether the supply will be there and what the cost will be. If things work out, great. If you can do renewable energy with a reliable, affordable battery storage, that's great. They're also counting very heavily on their greenhouse gas ambitions on carbon capture, which is unproven. It may prove itself out. It would be great if it does, but it's unproven. So there's some risks being taken on the direction they're going.
Well, there's risk. One risk is the ongoing drought that seems to get worse every year. You see the public photos of Lake Mead. They're filing old bodies that were whacked by the mafia down there in cement shoes and cars and all sorts of things. Is California going to be able to survive on hydropower without desalination pulling water in from the sea?
Yeah, hydro is another big issue for California. If serious drought continues, hydropower might prove to be the least of it. You've got one of the biggest cities in the world, well, in the United States anyway, in Southern California, that is utterly dependent on stable historic levels of water. And that's disappearing. Now, we don't know what the climate will be. There often are big fluctuations in rainfall, and it may prove to be temporary for the time being. But there's a serious issue of water for Los Angeles and the rest of California too, but especially Los Angeles to be considered. And in the short term, it's affecting the amount of hydropower, again, greenhouse gas-free hydropower. That also has drawbacks, including killing fish stocks and that kind of thing. So every form of energy has drawbacks, but it is greenhouse gas-free, and that's another thing that's being challenged.
LA with the water becomes power. Made a great movie in Chinatown with Jack Nicholson. Brilliant, brilliant movie. If you want to watch a dramatized version of water in Los Angeles in the early days, I highly recommend Chinatown. Los Angeles is starting to pick up on mobility. For years and years, when I was the co-chair of the Autonomous Vehicle Task Force City of Beverly Hills, we worked actively recruiting autonomous vehicle companies to Beverly Hills. And then I see the news, Waymo's expanding to Los Angeles. Go Team Waymo on that. It's been a long time in the making. What are your thoughts on Waymo expanding to LA?
I think LA is actually, it's one of the top ride-hailing markets in the world, actually. The streets are relatively flat and predictable. Even the pedestrians are predictable. I mean, anybody, if you're in California, there's pedestrians that'll walk into the street at any moment in San Francisco. If you go down to LA, people actually wait for the walk sign. So there are lots of ways that Los Angeles lends itself to the early stage of autonomous driving. So I think that I'm not sure what the business model is in terms of what it costs and what kind of revenue you can get and whether it makes sense as a business yet. But in terms of building out a customer base for these kind of vehicles, I think Los Angeles is as good a place as any and better than most.
It's a captive audience. If you want to go from Santa Monica to Beverly Hills or Santa Monica to downtown and you want to have a drink, Waymo will be a great way to get there. And I want to point out a fun little fact. In the early days of Waymo, when the I-PACE was announced, the press photos were taken in front of the Beverly Wilshire. They removed the BW logo. So I emailed John Krafcheck. I said, John, this looks really familiar. And John goes, I thought you were going to reach out. The same hotel that had Julia Roberts and Pretty Woman had the Waymo I-PACE. And it was a funny little thing. I was like, John, something's going on here. He goes, you'll see. And now it came there. But a fun little fact there on Waymo. Russ, This has been an insightful conversation around charging energy in California. We always love having you on here. We can't wait to welcome you back for the fifth time. And as we look to wrap up this insightful conversation, what would you like our listeners to take away with them today?
If you're interested in the EV phenomenon and you want to see it succeed, pay attention to what your states and local communities are doing about the public rollout of public charging stations. Whether you're in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Colorado, Oregon, California, all the states that are big on EVs, because if the chargers, public charger situation isn't fixed, the EV future could look pretty bleak.
We need charging reliability. SLA, service level agreements, are going to have to become mandatory. 100% uptime will have to become mandatory if we want to usher in an electric future, because the future is bright, the future is autonomous, and the future is charger reliability. Russ, thank you so much for coming on the Road to Autonomy today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Road to Autonomy podcast. If you've enjoyed listening, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Want to get in touch? Follow us on Twitter at Road to Autonomy or email podcast@brulteco.com. The Road to Autonomy is produced by Brulting Company. The views and opinions expressed on the Road to Autonomy podcast do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Brulte and Company. The content discussed on this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as legal, tax, investment, or business advice.